eating a little bit more. A little bit fatter, he said, patting his belly. Only thing changed is our tax bracket, said DJ Yella. Indeed, Dre had put on a few pounds, but they were also living much larger. At least Easy, Heller, and Dre, who joined the other two by purchasing a French colonial mansion in their Calabasas gated community in 1991. Miss Chalet outfitted the house with marble tables and special touches, included a huge fish tank that could be viewed from both sides, as well as a recording studio. Dre liked to host barbecues by the pool, with deafening music, and even amateur boxing matches. Jonathan Gold, writing for Rolling Stone, asked if his neighbors ever complained. They try to, he said, but I slammed the door in their face. I paid a mil plus for this house, so I figure I can do whatever the fuck I want to do in it. He spent recklessly to keep the good times going. He said he bought between 8 and 10 cars, Ferraris, Mercedes, Corvettes, and bankrolled a non-stop soiree. You could come over on Sunday morning, and there's just people laying out on the floor, asleep, he said. Heller lived a couple of blocks away. His cars included a white BMW with the license plate, RTHLSS2, which Easy bought for him. The rapper's matching version, same make and model, had RTHLSS1. Easy's pad, two doors down from Heller, boasted Graceland levels of goofy grandeur. A neon sign in the marble foyer read, Easy's Playhouse. The house included a pitch-black TV room complete with a laserdisc player, fluorescent pillows, and mirrors all around. He'd impress girls by bringing them there. A select few, said his assistant, Charisse Henry. Easy also collected various monster movie mementos, including a life-sized version of Hellraiser villain, Pinhead, with the nails in his skull, and a creepy Chucky doll from the horror movie Child's Play. Despite the fancy trappings, Easy didn't actually spend much time at the Calabasas home, since it was so isolated in the valley. He let friends and ruthless artists live there, as well as at his main house in Norwalk. Easy also had a home in Woodland Hills, close to Ruthless's offices, and in the shadow of the 101 freeway. You want to move in? Easy asked rapper Stefan, almost immediately after he signed with Ruthless in 1993. The Woodland Hills home's previous occupant, Easy's girlfriend, Tamika Woods, had moved into yet another of Easy's homes, in Topanga. Stefan took him up on the offer. It was like winning the lottery. The Republican Inner Circle. Despite the lavish living, Easy kept his focus on business. As he pondered how to promote NWA's upcoming second album, Niggas for Life, an opportunity fell into his lap. He'd somehow ended up on a Republican Party mailing list. It was likely owing to a charitable donation he'd made. In early 1991, he accepted an invitation from Texas Senator Phil Graham to hear President George H.W. Bush speak to a group of campaign contributors called the Republican Senatorial Inner Circle. Somehow, nobody put two and two together, and Easy received a follow-up letter from Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, which noted that Inner Circle members included Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sam Walton, and Estee Lauder. The cost? A mere $2,490 for two tickets, one for him and one for Heller, to an event called Salute to the Commander-in-Chief on March 18, 1991, 2 months before the new NWA album would drop. It would pay off in what Wright would characterize as $1 million worth of publicity. Easy arrived at D.C.'s National Airport, carrying his suit in a bag over his shoulder and signing autographs for fans. Ruthless had tipped off CBS News, and Bob Schaefer was there to report on the absurdity of the whole thing. Do you think the Republicans know who Easy is? He asked Heller, who responded that he doubted it. But as for us, the Ruthless manager went on, we're happy to be here. The event was held at the Omni Shoreham Hotel, not the White House as is claimed in the Straight Outta Compton film and often reported, and went off without a hitch. Easy showed his ticket, went through the metal detector, and dined on roast beef and salmon. Not everyone thought Easy's cavorting with right-wingers was funny. Though before the luncheon, Easy's PR flack told the Los Angeles Times that Easy was a big fan of Bush, Easy afterwards switched gears in an interview with Spin, complaining that many, including director Spike Lee, failed to get the joke. "I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I don't give a fuck. I don't even vote." The incident wasn't Easy's only brush with political controversy. He enraged the hip-hop community by publicly supporting Theodore Brezzano, one of the officers charged in the Rodney King trial. Easy met Brezzano through his lawyer, Harlan W. Braun, who also did work for Ruthless, and the rapper attended the 1993 federal trial. At a time when most people believed all four cops to be guilty, Easy put his reputation on the line by literally standing next to Brezzano. The pair made the Los Angeles Times front page, prompting Ghetto Boys rapper Willie D to call Easy a sellout. Easy responded that he believed Brezzano had attempted to stop the beating and that, despite the media's characterization of the four officers as white, Brezzano was a Latino. It is possible to be both white and Latino. Indeed, Brezzano did not hit Rodney King with a baton and broke ranks with the other officers at trial, saying their use of force was not justified. But he can clearly be seen in the video kicking King in the back of his head with his boot. "Sure, I've seen that little stomp Brezzano does on the video, and I'm not saying it's justified, but we don't know what it was about, do we?" Easy said. "It could have been him just trying to tell Rodney, stay down, man, stay down. Who's to know?" Easy sometimes didn't appear to be very sympathetic toward King. In a 1991 interview with Spin, he said, "Rodney King's all fucked up, man. He going out with transvestites now. He don't know what the fuck's going on. He don't know his ass from a hole in the ground." A rapper in Easy's own camp named BG Knockout was so enraged about Easy's support of Brezzano that he wrote a diss song about him. Ruthless rapper Toker said Easy later regretted standing by the officer. Whatever the case, one can't help admire Easy's chutzpah. He never did what anyone expected of him. This, along with the Bush fundraiser, were vintage contrarian Eazy-E. Temporary Insanity. In May 1991, Niggas for Life spelled backward, debuted at number 2. Many reviews were not flattering, but it reached Billboard's top slot the next week, displacing Paula Abdul's Spellbound and making it the first gangster rap album to hit number 1. Buoyed by a new system implemented by SoundScan that determined rankings not based on dodgy figures supplied by record store employees, but tabulations of actual sales. It was a watershed event, the moment when rap began its decades-long dominance of mainstream music. Niggas for Life also marks a great leap forward in Dr. Dre's production skills. Whereas Compton was all over the place sonically, Life is mostly unified in its doomsday grooves. Always Into Something is a slow-building sonic masterpiece, kicking off with a spoken word MC Ren introduction and a quick Dre verse before unveiling the alien-sounding high-pitched Moog synthesizer sound, similar to the funky worm Dre had employed on Dope Man. It would become a staple of Dre's solo work. Hoping to capture the magic of Parliament Funkadelic member Bernie Worrell's eerie melodic keyboard sounds, Dre had engineer Colin Wolfe go out and buy a Moog. On Niggas for Life, Dre realized that less is more, that silence on a track can be just as important as sound. Dre has a lot of space in his music. It's open. There's not always too much going on, said his future collaborator, DeJuan Parker. The bass lines are mostly played live in the studio. The funk of James Brown was also in his ears. And there's a real musicality. When you add in the taunts from Above the Law and Cocaine, along with Dre's own much-improved efforts as an MC, Life delivers on its rebellious R-rated promises. Once again, DJ Yella received a co-production credit on the album, but his contributions weren't on the level of Dre's. Owing to Ice Cube's departure, there's not much political commentary, though Niggas for Life addresses their use of the inflammatory word in the title. "Why do I call myself a nigga, you ask me?" MC Ren raps, "because police always want to harass me." "We didn't give ourselves this name," Easy elaborated around this time to a quasi-outraged NBC News reporter who asked why he used it so often. "People have been calling us niggas for years, and so we carry that word." To promote the album, Easy portrayed himself in the media less as a street soldier and more as a cartoonish psychotic with duct tape over his mouth and glasses missing a lens. For Arsenio, he donned a straitjacket and hockey mask. He even began putting together, but eventually scrapped, an album called Temporary Insanity. Today, Niggas for Life is not remembered as warmly as Straight Outta Compton. Ice Cube's voice is definitely missed. Whereas Cube's enemies were clearly defined, those who would suppress the black man, life's themes and antagonists aren't well drawn. Niggas for Life features blowjob tutorials, stories about girls who won't give it up, and tales of violence against women that range from cartoonish to appallingly realistic, especially considering Dre's history of abuse. "'Cause if a bitch tries to diss me while I'm full of liquor, I smack the bitch up and shoot the nigga that's with her," Dre raps on, "find him, fuck him, and flee." But mainly it seems shocking for the sake of being shocking. "We were trying to see how far we could push the envelope," Dre admitted. MC Ren perhaps found that limit on "She Swallowed It," in which his character preys on a preacher's 14-year-old daughter. "The bitch sucks dick like a specialized pro. She looked at me, I was surprised, but wasn't passing up the chance of my dick getting baptized." "I'd Rather Fuck You," Easy's lounge-style parody of Bootsy Collins's "I'd Rather Be With You," flips a straightforward love song into an Andrew Dice Clay-style seduction anthem. Singer Jewel, who'd recently done an impromptu audition for Dre in the corner of a club, sings on the chorus. "I was thinking, oh my God, my mom is going to kill me for being on the song," she remembered. Owing to the album's sex and violence, reaction from social conservatives was swift. Libraries banned the album. British police confiscated thousands of copies, and Minnesota's Attorney General Hubert Skip Humphrey III, son of the former vice president, called its lyrics nothing but filth, and threatened to prosecute Minneapolis-based record store chain Musicland Group if it sold Niggas for Life to minors. Ultimately, the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office determined the work didn't violate Minnesota's statutes. Despite receiving little radio airplay, they didn't bother recording a radio-friendly track without cursing. Niggas for Life went platinum. "We ain't selling out. Fuck crossing over to them. Let them cross over to us," MC Ren said at a live show in 1989. He had no idea how prophetic his words would be. Beating up the charts. The nationally syndicated TV hip-hop show, Pump It Up, launched in 1989, a counterpart to Yo MTV Raps that mixed videos with artist interviews. The program was hosted by Dee Barnes, a petite, Afrocentric rapper from a duo called Body and Soul, who were signed to Delicious Vinyl and rapped on We're All in the Same Gang. They once recorded a demo in Alonzo Williams' house, co-produced by Dr. Dre. Barnes's interviews, like her music, tended to be upbeat, though she didn't shy away from asking tough questions. She, along with her sometime co-host, ruthless rapper Stefan, featured everyone from De La Soul to Biz Markie to N.W.A. Barnes began hanging out with Dre at one point, though it's unclear in exactly what capacity. When Dre was asked by The Source in 1992 if he and Barnes had been romantically involved, he said, "So-so," though Barnes denied it. In November 1990, Pump It Up did another story on N.W.A., who were on the tail end of promoting the EP, 100 Miles and Running. The interview went fine, but the editing of the piece angered the group. Following their segment, was Barnes's interview with rapper Yo-Yo on the set of the Boys in the Hood movie. Ice Cube crashed the interview. On camera, he disparaged his former group and mocked the title of their EP. "I got all you suckers 100 miles and running," he said. N.W.A. had dissed Cube in the episode as well, but they hadn't been told Cube would have a chance to respond and felt the editing made it look like he had the final word. Reportedly, Barnes herself wasn't a fan of the final cut, chosen by a producer, but the group blamed her. "She tried to make us look stupid," MC Ren said. "Tried to play us in front of millions of people." On January 27, 1991, at a West Hollywood nightclub called Po Na Na Souk, Def Jam hosted a record release party for a group called BWP, or Bitches with Problems. Niggas with Attitudes had opened the floodgates for tough girl groups with three-word names, including Ruthless Axe, HWA, Hoes with Attitudes, and GBM, Gangsta Bitch Mentality. At the Def Jam event, the liquor was flowing freely, and Dre later admitted to Spin that he was drunk. Doug Young, NWA's promoter, was talking to D. Barnes when Dre and a bodyguard walked up to them. Dre looked over to her, said, "That was some fucked up shit you did, bitch, on that show," Young recalled in an interview with me. "Then Dre suddenly hit her in the face," Young said. "He just fired on her. Bam! I saw the punch, and I just saw her fall like a sack of potatoes. He grabbed me by my hair, picked me up, and started slamming me into a brick wall," said Barnes, who was nearly a foot shorter than Dre and weighed about half as much. Dre's bodyguard held back the crowd, she added in a statement. According to eyewitness accounts, Dre began kicking her and tried to push her down a flight of stairs. She fled to a bathroom, but Dre followed her in and began beating her more. Doug Young said the room full of spectators watched and did nothing.
"I was thinking, he's trying to kill me," Barnes said.
The police and ambulance were called, but Dre was hustled out without being arrested. Barnes suffered bruises on her face and recorded episodes of Pump It Up behind dark glasses.
"Dre was like a big brother to me," she told Rolling Stone in August 1991. "I still get very emotional about it."
The day after the beating, Dre told The Source Barnes called to say she wasn't going to press charges. "She soon changed her tune," he went on, saying that if he wanted to avoid court, he was going to have to produce some songs for her group. "Without putting my name on it or anything like that, and they would forget it." Dre said he agreed to the deal, but that Barnes later reneged and instead wanted $1 million.
"I was like, what? Fuck you. Take me to court," Dre said he responded. "Next thing I know, the shit is in every motherfucking newspaper there is, and I'm in court."
The alleged Lisa Johnson, Miss Chalet, and Terry B. beatings had never been reported in the media. But following D. Barnes's attack, the allegations against Dre were widely publicized. Rolling Stones entitled its first major story on NWA, "Beating Up the Charts." Barnes, fearing for her safety, hired a member of fearsome Samoan rap crew, the Booyah Tribe, to act as security.
"She's going through a lot of emotional turmoil," said her mother, Joan Barnes. "The first 3 months, we were both really paranoid. Now it's gone beyond fear. We're just trying to exist."
Statements Dre made to reporters further fueled the situation.
"It ain't no big thing. I just threw her through a door," he told Rolling Stone,
and Easy and Ren callously defended him, bragging about the beating and offering further intimidations. Said Ren,
"It's not over yet."
Barnes's mother speculated that the violence of NWA's songs was coming to life.
"They started believing what they were writing," she said.
In August 1991, Dre pleaded no contest to battery charges. His sentence was a $2,400 fine, 240 hours of community service, and probation. He was also ordered to pay $1,000 to a victim's restitution fund,
and to make an anti-violence public service announcement. Barnes also filed a $20 million civil lawsuit against him that was settled out of court for six figures.
People think I was paid millions, when in reality I didn't even get a million, and it wasn't until September of 1993. He and his lawyers dragged their feet the whole way, Barnes wrote.
For many years after the incident, Dre never offered a formal public apology. Following the release of the Straight Outta Compton movie in 2015, his abuse allegations again became news.
25 years ago, I was a young man drinking too much and in over my head with no real structure in my life, he told the New York Times. He continued, I apologize to the women I've hurt. I deeply regret what I did and know that it has forever impacted all of our lives.
In his statement, Dre partly tied his abuse to alcoholism. But Johnson and others who knew him in the early and mid-80s, including world-class Wrecking Crew companions, told me he didn't have a drinking problem in this time. His alleged abuse of Lisa Johnson occurred in 1984 and 1985. Dre said he started boozing following the death of his brother Tyree in 1989.
I think that triggers it because he turns into somebody else, said Miss Chalet.
Terry B. also said Dre had been drinking before he hit her, which was seconded by her manager Linda Martinez. Barnes says the incident with Dre cast a spell over her life. She was blacklisted from further television work, she wrote, because potential employers didn't want to threaten their relationships with Dre and ended up working a series of 9-to-5 jobs to live.
I suffer from horrific migraines that started only after the attack, she went on. I love Dre's song, Keep Their Heads Ringing. It has a particularly deep meaning to me. When I get migraines, my head does ring, and it hurts, exactly in the same spot every time where he smashed my head against the wall.
Chapter 11. The Enforcer. Marion Knight Jr. entered the ruthless fold, quietly. Nicknamed Shug by his dad, he was said to be sweet like a sugar bear. He was something of a mama's boy, regularly sending her roses. His father, who once sang in an R&B group, worked in UCLA's laundry and housekeeping departments and, later, as a truck driver.
No matter how hard he worked, he barely had enough money to buy himself an extra beer, Shug told Esquire. I made up my mind that I wanted everything, and nothing would stop me.
Shug was raised in a Piru Bloods-controlled section of Compton, but he didn't join any gangs, and they left him alone because he was a football star at Linwood High School.
His dad used to pay him for every sack, said Sharitha Golden,
who began dating him in high school and later became his wife. He attended El Camino Community College on scholarship and later transferred to University of Nevada, Las Vegas on scholarship, where he was a standout defensive end.
I used to go to football practice in college and see how many teammates I could hurt, he said.
He may have been exaggerating. His coach, Wayne Nunnally, said Shug wasn't a problem guy at all, and he didn't really see that street roughness about him. He loved soul music, Sam Cooke, Donnie Hathaway, as well as hip-hop, and on the weekends, he worked at clubs as a security guard. In 1987, Shug was offered a contract with the San Francisco 49ers, but he lost it after being arrested following an altercation with a friend named Ricardo Ricky Crockett, with whom he had a dispute. Las Vegas police accused him of shooting Crockett and then taking his car on October 31st that year, and he was charged with attempted murder and grand theft auto, although in the end, he pleaded guilty to misdemeanors, receiving 3 years probation and a $1,000 fine. In 1993, Crockett was accused of trafficking drugs between Las Vegas and L.A. The same federal probe also named Knight. Crockett was convicted on drug charges, but Knight was found guilty only of gun possession, receiving probation. Shug was devastated about losing his shot with the 49ers, but returned home and successfully tried out for the Los Angeles Rams. joining the team in 1987 for a pair of games when its regular players went on strike. But his NFL career was short-lived. His on-again, off-again girlfriend, Sharitha Golden, said he skipped out on Rams training camp one day and showed up at her mother's house. He wasn't invited. They were in a rough patch. She nonetheless agreed to get into his car to talk. All of a sudden, he pulls my ponytail down. He reached back in the seat pocket of the car, and he pulls out these scissors, she told filmmaker S. Leigh Savage. He cut my ponytail clean off. She filed a restraining order against him, but it didn't totally sour things. And by the end of the 80s, they were married. Over the years, the soft-spoken Suge has portrayed himself as simultaneously innocent and sinister, a product of the streets where he grew up. Sometimes you end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, he said. But the way I was raised, it was like this here. The only things you have are your word and your manhood. No matter what they say about you, before anything else, you got to be a man. His football career finished. He worked security at the Forum, then home of the Lakers. He also became R&B singer Bobby Brown's bodyguard. But his big break would come from meeting D.O.C. through a mutual friend, Andre L.A. Dre Bolton, who played keyboards on a number of Ruthless Records albums. L.A. Dre and Suge would help D.O.C., fresh from Dallas and not yet legal drinking age, get into clubs, D.O.C. said. The rapper was mesmerized by this new scene, populated by celebrities like Eddie Murphy and Prince, and older women who were hitting on him. It was heaven, D.O.C. said. Jerry Heller said Suge was employed by Ruthless as a $70 per day bodyguard, but D.O.C. denied this. He insisted Suge simply latched on to him, serving as his protector more or less because he enjoyed pounding people. Suge got off on that shit. It was fun to him, D.O.C. said. If I got drunk and slapped a girl's ass and her guy got upset, Suge would beat the motherfucker up, and then we'd just leave. When I sought comment from Suge in 2015, his lawyer said he was not available, owing to his imprisonment. The pair grew especially close following D.O.C.'s crash, with Suge doting on him every day in the hospital. Whatever I needed him to do, he handled, D.O.C. said. Suge also helped him set up autograph sessions and other revenue-generating appearances. Suge mainly stayed out of the limelight, at least at first. NWA affiliate Crazy D had no idea who he was when he encountered him in April 1990 at the Celebrity Theater in Anaheim, the same night Above the Law and Ice Cube got into it. Hanging out backstage, Crazy D approached D.O.C. What's up, nigga? He said. He hadn't meant anything by the comment. He was simply making conversation. But Suge, 6'2" and topping out over 300 pounds, seemed to think Crazy D was talking trash. Their conversation grew heated, and Crazy D threatened to call for reinforcements. At that point, Suge knocked Crazy D through a closed door, remembered eyewitness DJ Speed. Crazy D said Suge sucker-punched him as hard as he could, right in the face. He hit me really hard, he told me, adding that his face became swollen and his eye turned black. Some of my teeth shifted. Crazy D went home and later discussed the situation with Easy, who recommended suing. Dre intervened, inviting Crazy D to Solar Records in Hollywood, where he was recording. Upon arriving, Crazy D was taken down a long, dark hallway into a dark office. I thought I was being set up, he said. Suge was inside and invited him to sit down. They shook hands.
I didn't know who you were, and I just wanted to apologize to you, Suge said, according to Crazy D. I thought you were trying to argue with D.O.C.
Suge's apparent philosophy was that it was easier to ask forgiveness than permission, though certainly not everyone got an apology. Cunning and ambitious, he let his fists cash his checks, and demand grew for his skills as an enforcer. Most famously, he pursued Vanilla Ice, the white rapper who dominated pop music at the beginning of the 90s with his blow-dried do, daffy rhymes, and quite suave dance moves. Vanilla Ice's debut album, To the Extreme, sold 7 million copies, propelled by hit Ice Ice Baby, which he claimed to have written when he was 16. However, a rapper named Mario Johnson, who went by Chocolate and was signed to Suge's management company, told Suge that while working with Vanilla Ice in Texas, he helped write many of the album's songs, but hadn't received just compensation. Suge said he would handle the situation. And this is where the tale becomes tall. The oft-repeated story is that Suge shook down Vanilla Ice for his publishing by dangling him by his ankles over a hotel balcony. That never happened, according to Chocolate, Vanilla Ice, and Suge. In reality, Suge first tried negotiating in good faith, producing as evidence Chocolate's original handwritten lyrics for songs including Ice Ice Baby. A girlfriend had also apparently witnessed him scribbling them down. But Ice's record company didn't take Suge's claim seriously, telling him,
"Look, we'll give you a couple of dollars if you let bygones be bygones," Suge told BET in 1996. "I wouldn't go for it."
He ultimately decided to take his appeal to Vanilla Ice himself. The former defensive end and a group of large men interrupted the white rapper's meal at downtown L.A. Steakhouse, The Palm. "They were bigger than my bodyguards," Vanilla Ice said. "They pretty much grabbed my bodyguards, pulled them out, and sat down next to me right there and started talking to me." The conversation didn't amount to much more than vague intimidations, but Suge's crew tracked them down again a few months later.
"I'm thinking, wow, this guy knows where I'm at all times,"
Vanilla Ice said, explaining how Suge showed up at his Beverly Hills hotel room one night with a half dozen armed men.
"We knew where he was staying because I was supposed to be hearing some tracks he was doing," Chocolate said. "He wanted me to come by myself, but Suge said, 'I'm going with you.'"
Ice said Suge's entourage roughed up his security guys and then took him out onto the balcony of the 15th floor room.
"He had me look over the edge, showing me how high I was up there. I needed to wear a diaper on that day," he said.
Suge demanded he sign away points, a percentage of royalties from the record, and Vanilla Ice consented, despite insisting that Chocolate had nothing to do with Ice Ice Baby. He estimated that the points he gave up were worth $3 to $4 million. Suge denied that his men were armed, or that Vanilla Ice had to be strong-armed.
"He agreed to everything. It wasn't a problem," he countered. "He said the guy wrote the song."
Chocolate said his side subsequently sued successfully for his royalties through regular legal channels. It took more than a year before money started coming in, but then it came like a geyser. Rapper CPO recalled being later invited to Chocolate's stunning new house. When giving directions, Chocolate told him,
"Come up the hill. My house is the one with the two Porsches and the white Benz."
Suge got his cut too, and he and Sharitha got a home in Alta Loma. The Smell of Leadership. Suge may have been a bully, but he was not a common thug. Around 1989, he started spending time with the Ruthless Artists and closely observing what was going on behind the scenes.
"I investigated and found out who do the writing and the music, and how do they get paid," he said.
Suge soon linked up with an agent named Tom Klein, who represented athletes and was trying to branch out into the music industry. The two of them, with DOC, planned to start a label called Funky Enough Records, named after the DOC hit song. At this point, DOC believed his voice could still potentially be rehabilitated. Suge began auditioning rappers out of Klein's Beverly Hills office, even recruiting up-and-coming rapper-producer DJ Quick for the label. But DOC was getting cold feet about the venture. To succeed, he felt they needed something more. They needed Dre. So, Suge began strategizing how to get the producer on board. He quickly surmised that Dre was disgruntled with his contract, the same document that caused Ice Cube to walk. By this point, Dre and Easy had been tight for about 5 years, but Dre was growing increasingly irate about his earnings. He wasn't poor. He had his Calabasas mansion, but Dre felt he should be making top dollar, considering that the platinum and gold albums he'd produced for J.J. Fad, N.W.A., Eazy-E, D.O.C., and Michelle A. had generated tens of millions of dollars in sales. Remember, these were $15 CDs and $10 tapes, not $1.29 downloads. It's unclear how much Dre was paid in total, but Heller told Rolling Stone, Dre made about $86,000 from Ruthless in 1992, a figure that seems almost comically low. Easy took advantage of me not knowing the record business back in the day, Dre said. He also blamed Heller for the skewed contracts he signed. Dre resented being paid as an employee instead of as an owner. In his mind, he and Easy had founded Ruthless together. Easy denied this, and no one gave Dre's claim much credence, considering he didn't have any paperwork to back it up. But he may have been right. Easy's close friend and artist Toker said Easy later privately admitted as much. If Dre indeed co-founded Ruthless, he would have received a greater share of the proceeds, perhaps millions. Around the time of Cube's departure, Dre gradually began confiding in Suge about his financial concerns. Suge eventually began managing Dre and Above the Law. Why would the well-established Dre suddenly get in cahoots with an undistinguished, shadowy newcomer? One explanation is Suge's personality. Alonzo Williams, who'd seen Dre jump ship with the world-class Wrecking Crew during a different financial dispute, characterized Dre as easily swayed by the smell of strong leadership, by someone willing to handle financial details while he focused on making music. He was an aggressive person that cleared the way for me to go in and do what I had to do, Dre said of Suge. By any means necessary. And so, when Dre asked him to take a look at his contract in early 1991, Suge simply showed up one day unannounced at Ruthless's lawyer's office, grabbed what he wanted, and departed the premises. We found out that Cube was right, Suge said. Ruthless was taking Dre for a ride. And not just Dre. Every other artist on the roster, too. Was Dre really being taken for a ride? Legally, the answer is likely no. Dre never filed any lawsuit against Ruthless. More likely, he'd simply signed an unfavorable deal, similar to decades worth of artists before him. Legality aside, Ruthless probably should have done more to accommodate their franchise player. Doug Young, NWA's promoter, and a relatively neutral third-party observer, believed Easy should have offered to renegotiate the contracts. Indeed, Heller tried to sweeten the pot for Dre in other ways. He attempted to create a sub-label for him through Warner that, he said, would have paid Dre a $2 million advance. But Warner was clearly spooked by the FBI's letter, Jerry noted, and balked. Priority Records, Ruthless's distributor, however, did step up to the plate. Around this time, they gave Dre $250,000, according to Dre's testimony in a 1991 deposition, $100,000 for a future album, and $150,000 for back payments. Priority could afford it. Buoyed by gangsta rap, the label was later sold to EMI, in a deal rumored to exceed $100 million, and co-founders Brian Turner and Mark Cerami bought homes worth millions. But they kept Ruthless out of the loop, which infuriated Heller, and further strained the relationship between Ruthless and Priority, the latter of which was now the label home of Ice Cube. Turner was obviously trying to induce Dre to leave Ruthless like he did Ice Cube, Heller said. There is no legal legitimate explanation why he offered him this money. Easy would later blame Priority for NWA's demise. But at the center of the dispute was the collapse of the relationship between Easy and Dre themselves, with Heller's influence looming large. I'm recording platinum records and getting 2 points as a producer, Dre said, referencing the relatively modest percentage of royalties he said he was receiving. So I stepped to Easy at this time and told him, "Look, man, I'm not dealing with Jerry Heller anymore. I don't want him in my mixture. I said, if I'm going to stay, he has to go. It's one of the two." According to Dre, Easy thought about his ultimatum for a couple of days and decided that he was going to stick with the veteran manager. So that was that. But complicating matters, Dre was still under contract with Easy, barring him from recording with another label. And Easy had no intention of letting him go quietly. "We know where your mother lives." In the popular imagination, Suge Knight is synonymous with rap world thuggery. Over the years, he's been accused of beating and murdering his adversaries, as well as financial crimes running from embezzlement to extortion. He punishes and humiliates others for the slightest offenses, some say forcing them to disrobe in front of him or to drink urine from champagne flutes. Suge has done much to propagate this image, from his mob boss-style cigar habit to his blood-red Ford F-150 Raptor, with which in 2015 he allegedly ran over two men, killing one and then fleeing the scene. And yet under Suge's watch, Death Row Records released some of the most beloved and important albums in music history. With a traditional suit-wearing record label executive at the company's helm, it's highly unlikely these works would have been made or had the same impact. The thing I like most about him is that he don't ever let my shit get watered down. He keeps the music real, said Snoop Doggy Dogg. He's got an ear to the street. To keep the music real, Suge twisted some arms. According to Eazy-E, he intimidated him into signing over Dr. Dre's contract. Eazy told the story numerous times, and even testified to it under oath. Though some details vary, and Dre denied any involvement, it goes roughly like this. Late in the evening on April 23, 1991, Eazy received a call or a page from Dr. Dre asking to meet up. He said he wanted to work out their differences, and so Eazy headed over to Solar, parking in the dark basement lot, and heading upstairs to a studio known as Galaxy. Dre was not there, however. Instead, Suge Knight greeted him when he got off the elevator, along with two or three bulky men. They held oversized lead pipes or Louisville sluggers, and possibly had guns bulging from their pants. One thing was clear. Eazy was outmanned and under-weaponized. He was led to a dark, soundproof room. "Where Dre at?" Eazy asked. Suge ignored the question, and instead levied an allegation.
"I heard you was trying to get me killed, blood."
Indeed, Heller has said Eazy batted around the idea of having Suge offed. Suge then pulled out some documents, which were purportedly designed to let Dr. Dre, DLC, Michelle A, and Above the Law out of their ruthless contracts. In one version of this story, the papers gave some concessions to Ruthless. Dre would finish the yet-unreleased N.W.A. album, Niggas for Life, and Suge would negotiate better terms for Ruthless with Priority. In all versions of the story, Eazy told him where he could stick the releases. At this point, Suge twisted the screws. "We have Jerry Heller tied up in a van," he said, "and we know where your mother lives." As proof, he presented a scrap of paper with an address, or a picture of the house, depending on the account. Whatever the case, this threat was entirely credible, considering Eazy had openly stamped his home address on his earliest printings of records. And so Eazy signed the papers. He was not beat up by Suge's men as depicted in Straight Outta Compton.
"He didn't want anything to happen to his mom, and he signed under duress," his girlfriend Tamika Woods said in the 2008 documentary, N.W.A., The World's Most Dangerous Group.
"At first," he wrote, "Mickey Mouse," she added. But eventually he was forced to take the proceedings seriously. What else was he going to do? Suge later denied all of this, taking the opportunity to belittle Eazy.
"Do I need a bat to force him to do a few things?
he said at an August 1993 death row press conference.
If he walked between my legs, excuse my French, people would probably think he was my penis.
One thing was clear. These releases weren't worth the paper they were printed on. Since Easy signed under duress, the releases weren't binding. He sent letters to the major record companies warning them against signing Dre. Easy may have won the battle, but Suge would not be deterred. His stunt drove home the point that Dre was truly done with Ruthless Records. Who cared if he was still technically under contract? If he didn't put forth his best efforts, it made no difference. Suge Knight kept showing up at the Niggas for Life recording sessions, leading to a tense atmosphere. After that album, and Dr. Dre's producing an experimental work from multi-instrumentalist Jimmy Z called Musical Madness that includes Ron Burgundy-style jazz flute, Dre was effectively done at the label. DOC gave yet another version of these events. He said Dre left Ruthless at his behest so they could start a label together. He, Dre, and Suge did, in fact, soon quietly launch a label called Future Shock, named for a Curtis Mayfield song. Their fourth partner in the venture was Dick Griffey, a veteran music industry player, founder of Solar Records, and co-founder of Soul Train Records. The name wouldn't stick.
Future Shock Records, Suge said. That sounds like some bullshit. It's gonna be called Death Row. Because once you get on this label, that's the end.
Easy and Heller plotted their next move, emerging with a legal plan they hoped would drive Suge Knight back underground. On August 23, 1991, Ruthless lawyers filed suit against Suge, Dre, Death Row, Sony, Solar, and others, claiming they had violated the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations RICO Act, a federal law generally used to take down the mafia and other organized crime targets. The suit leveled charges of extortion, racketeering, and money laundering against the record companies and brass, including top Sony executive Tommy Mottola. Sony, Death Row, and Solar were guilty of conspiring to put Ruthless out of business, the lawsuit claimed. As Ruthless argued, Dre hadn't just left because Suge charmed him. He left because Sony Records secretly offered him a boatload of money. Those release forms Easy signed under duress? Those had been drafted by one of Sony's attorneys, Ruthless insisted. Heller's lawyer Michael Bourbeau claimed that immediately after Easy signed the releases, Suge sent a fax to a pair of executives at Sony's Epic subsidiary, David Glue and Hank Caldwell. The fax said Dre was available for all production work, and it asked for $125,000 in advance, Bourbeau said. How much Dre received from Sony isn't clear, but in April 1992, Epic and Solar co-released the soundtrack to the drug world thriller Deep Cover. The title track was produced and performed by Dr. Dre, along with newcomer Snoop Doggy Dogg. To The Source, Easy expressed incredulity that Sony thought they could get away with this, asserting the company knew full well Dre was still under contract. Sony's lawyers argued that Dre's contract with Ruthless actually did permit him to make music for other labels. Sony was very careful, said Wayne Smith, part of Sony's legal team. They only signed Dre to the rights Ruthless didn't have.
Muscle and tactics. While the two sides battled in court, a culture of fear set in at Ruthless. Following Suge's intimidations, Heller began taking a different route home each night. He stashed guns throughout his house and installed an expensive security system. His fears were not unfounded. Suge and about five carloads of dudes suddenly showed up at Easy's Norwalk house one day, said DJ Speed, who was living there at the time. Suge demanded the reels, the master recordings Dre had produced at Ruthless. Speed peered at them through protective bars shielding the house, he said, and told them they were out of luck. The men left. Easy had hoped to jettison the violence of his past. He had attempted to run a legitimate business.
even moving into a fancy office building in the suburbs. But playing by the rules wasn't working. Suge was growing brazen, and their run-in made him look weak. His longtime collaborator was out the door. His empire was crumbling. Ruthless needed to increase its firepower. Heller recruited a security director, an Israeli named Mike Klein, whose job was to put the fear of God into their adversaries. Klein had a background in Israeli security forces, Heller wrote, but was currently working in the garment business for a company out of Canoga Park, near Ruthless's first offices. Nobody seems to know the specifics of Klein's background, wrote Vibe. Before he moved to Los Angeles, says somebody who knows him, the Israeli-born Klein led a commando raid into southern Lebanon when they caught those guys who blew up the kibbutz kids on the school bus.
That stuff I can't comment on, Klein responded to the magazine.
I was unable to contact him for an interview. Klein was lean with thinning hair, wore an expensive gold bracelet, and spoke in a deep voice with an accent. Ruthless producer Rhythm D said he was a dead ringer for the actor, Peter Samari, who played Carl Hungus in The Big Lebowski.
Nobody messed with him, Rhythm added.
Indeed, by all accounts, he was an incredible badass, a martial arts expert who also took the Ruthless team to the gun range for target practice. Klein offered muscle and tactics when you talk to people, said Tamika Woods. Rhythm D found this to be true. He'd produced songs for rapper Paperboy, including his breakout 1993 hit, Diddy, but hadn't received his proper royalties for his work, he said. That is, until he linked up with Ruthless, and Heller set up a meeting with the owners of Paperboy's label. He didn't have to do nothing but bring Big Mike in the room, Rhythm said, and we did the contracts. Rapper Crazy Bone, whose group Bone Thugs and Harmony later signed to Ruthless, recalled an occasion when the group complained about money they felt the label owed them. Easy assigned Klein to take care of them, and so the Israeli took them to his home, which looked like something out of a mafia movie, like The Godfather complete with an elevator, said Crazy. Klein then produced a duffel bag full of cash totaling $20,000, which he handed to them. The guys took the money, but were stupefied.
We was like, "Aw, shit," Crazy said.
For further aid in their battle with Death Row, Klein and Heller enlisted the services of the Jewish Defense League, a New York-based organization that seeks to protect Jews against anti-Semitism, and which the FBI regards as a right-wing extremist group for its violent tactics. The JDL provided Ruthless with bodyguards. Before long, there were Israeli soldiers wielding Uzi machine guns at the office, wrote S. Lay Savage, a filmmaker who visited the Ruthless headquarters in this period.
It felt like a military zone. I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could.
In 1997, the FBI began a 2-year investigation into the JDL, which they suspected were extorting rappers including Easy and Tupac Shakur. The alleged scam went like this. Someone would make death threats to the artists, and then someone else with whom they were in cahoots would offer to protect the artists for $50,000 or so, at which time they'd be taken to a safe spot until a deal could be worked out with the perpetrators of the threat. The FBI closed the case without filing charges, and the JDL spokesman Irv Rubin stated in a press release that there was nothing but a close, tight relationship between the organization and Eazy-E. Easy credited Klein with helping deflate the Suge menace for the time being, and later made him the company's director of business affairs. At a time when the label was strapped for cash, Klein invested his own money, making him a part owner, and when Easy decided it was time to part ways with Priority, Klein helped negotiate Ruthless's deal with a new distribution company called Relativity. In the middle of all of this, Klein and Suge, the two baddest enforcers come executives in West Coast hip-hop, helped negotiate Dre's release from Ruthless. The RICO lawsuit didn't go anywhere. A vast conspiracy was hard to prove, and a judge dismissed the case in 1993. But Klein helped salvage the situation for Ruthless, Since Dre wasn't going to make music for Easy and Heller, the most they could hope for was a cut of profits from music he made elsewhere. With Klein, Heller, Easy, and their attorneys on one side of the table, and Dre, Suge's lawyer David Kenner, and Jimmy Iovine of Interscope, the fledgling label that became Death Row's distributor in 1992, on the other, the terms of Dre's departure were hammered out. Ruthless would receive publishing rights from his new projects, whether as rapper or producer. According to Heller, Ruthless would get 10% of Dre's producing proceeds and 15% from his own albums, as well as a huge advance. Easy said the terms were to last for 6 years.
"The same records that you making is paying me,"
Easy would later rap, and he wouldn't be lying. Despite the settlement, Suge never ceased trying to get under Easy's skin. At the 1992 Death Row Christmas party, he announced a new rapper at the label, Tracy Jernigan, the mother of one of Easy's children. Even though he'd also been with other women, their relationship had endured, but lately she and Easy had been feuding, and she'd taken to spending more time with Suge, a platonic friend dating back to her pre-Easy days. The word that she would be rapping for Death Row quickly got back to Easy, who was incensed.
"You embarrassed me," he said. "How could you be over there with them?"
She argued that he hadn't exactly been loyal to her, and they eventually made up. In truth, Jernigan wasn't particularly serious about her hip-hop career, which would stall out not long afterward. In retrospect, she suspects that beyond just interest in her as an artist, Suge was also probably messing with Eric and being funny and kind of taunting him. The Villain in Black. Of all the people caught in the middle of the Death Row and Ruthless feud, it was perhaps most difficult for the remaining NWA members, DJ Yella and MC Ren, who declined to throw barbs at either side and did their best to stay neutral.
Dre said, "I'm leaving, you want to come?"
said DJ Yella.
I was like, I'll let you know.
He stayed with Ruthless, as did MC Ren, who released the platinum EP, Kiss My Black Ass, in 1992, and the full-length Shock of the Hour in 1993. The latter is something like two separate albums in one. Its first half is dominated by the gangsta invective he's known for, braggadocio, brutal sex, and gunfights. But the second half takes a hard left turn, influenced by Ren's real-life conversion to the Nation of Islam during the album's recording. Ice Cube signee Cam appears on the title track, which describes an apocalyptic hellscape in which those who haven't recognized the nation's teachings suffer the consequence. Ren raps,
"Motherfucker should've listened when you got your final call. Think you're doing the brothers a favor by buying a paper. Should've read your paper. It tells you the devil raped you, stripped you of the scripture, blood you, then he crypt you."
Ren raps best when he's fired up, when he has a cause, and Shock of the Hour second half presents him as a man on a mission. His wordplay is on point, his inferno vividly drawn. The album got good reviews. Jonathan Gold called it, in the Los Angeles Times, a small, ugly masterpiece of gangster rap. But Ren's momentum nonetheless slowed, owing in part to his conflicts with Ruthless, who he also didn't believe was paying him properly. It's not that he didn't have other options. Dr. Dre took him to check out the scene at Death Row, but Ren didn't want any part of it.
"My street smart said, fuck this. This is a worse situation," he said.
No such infrastructure. While Ren tried to make the most of things at Ruthless, Dre dove into his new life at Death Row. But once again, he didn't take much care when it came to financial details.
"He didn't write checks. He didn't sign nothing," wrote Bruce Williams, who became Dre's assistant shortly thereafter, in 1993.
"He wouldn't do no paperwork." DOC said their original deal for the company that became Death Row gave 35% ownership to him, 35% to Dre, 15% to Suge, and 15% to Solars, Dick Griffey. Griffey was a key player in the deal, because he had national distribution with CBS Records, and Death Row was